Welcome. I'm Alex Sloan. Happy Canberran, and I'd like to acknowledge we're on Ngunnawal Ngambri land. Actually, there's been a development this afternoon with and an apology from the ACT government to Dr. Auntie Matilda House and Paul House, and a win about Ngambri being acknowledged. So that's a bit of news this afternoon.
Lovely.
Well, yeah, good on them. Country that's never been ceded, and we thank our First Peoples for their past and ongoing custodianship of this land. And speaking personally, I'm looking forward to the referendum later this year, a modest and simple request asking us to acknowledge our First Peoples in the Constitution and to allow them a seat at the table when laws and policies that affect them are being formulated and discussed. If you're finding the current retail politics a bit challenging, my tip is to take time to read the Uluru Statement. It really will top you up. And remember that the old people at the Uluru Convention in 2017 were very clear that the statement was a generous gift to us, the Australian people, not politicians. And that in 1967, the Australian people did the right thing, and they trust that we're going to do the right thing this time. History is calling. I'm delighted to be part of this launch of writer Alison Boo's latest novel, Bellevue. It's very much about country and how we manage it, about uniting to make a difference. Now, Alison was born in Melbourne, brought up in Sydney, and has spent over two decades studying, living and working in the UK before returning to Australia some 15 years ago. Her fiction has been translated into French, and her short stories have appeared in international publications, including Antipodes and New Writing. Her fiction awards include a Varuna Longlines Fellowship from the Eleanor Dark Foundation, and the highly commended award in 2011 and the ACT Book of the Year Award. Alison is also Emeritus Professor at the ANU, a Fellow of the Academy of Social Sciences in Australia, a Fellow of the Econometric Society and recipient of the Distinguished Fellow Award from the Economic Society of Australia. Bellevue is Alison's seventh novel. There are many copies for sale. Just buy yourself a dozen, because you don't take wine anymore. You take a locally written novel. That is my tip. And look, in a nutshell, and I'm using Alison's word here, Bellevue is about green bands, strong women, and the Blue Mountains. And please give her a hearty welcome. Now, Alison is going to be in conversation tonight with Professor Frank Bongiorno. Frank Bongiorno AM is ANU Professor of History and a historian of Australia. He was formerly Head of School of History and Deputy Director Education of the Research School of Social Sciences. He's currently President of the Australian Historical Association. And Frank's most recently published book, Dreamers and Schemers, A Political History of Australia, is described by Professor Judith Brent as a masterpiece of comprehensiveness and compression. And Judith Brent adds in the same review that Frank Bongiorno is a contender as the leading Australian historian of his generation. Add to that Frank's beautiful additions on Twitter. His careful choice of words is so important. His latest, and I'll quote, just so doing some work on Morrison, and was reminded in my reading of the Needles in Strawberry affair, what a pissant of a PM he was. Please welcome Frank Bongiorno. There will be time for questions towards the end. To quote my friend Colin Steele, the great hero of ANU Meet the Author, who is here tonight, make sure there is a question mark at the end. But right away, just a double welcome to Alison Booth and Frank Bongiorno, and take it away, Frank.
Thanks so much, Alex, for that lovely introduction to the book and to both of us. And thank you again to Alison for such a wonderful novel. Really privileged to be involved in the festivities around this one, the third that we've spoken about together, and an absolute delight to read. Now, it's interesting, your last novel, Alison, was, I guess, really set in the 1980s, although also in many ways set in earlier periods, reflecting back on historical memory. This one is set in 1972. It has a blue mountain setting. The last one was set in Sydney, so we're moving westward, I guess. We're moving westward. And it's about contemporary battles, really, over the environment and over heritage. So I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about why you chose that particular setting and that theme.
I have had a very long association with the Blue Mountains. Four generations of my family have spent time there, still spending time there. And once with my mother, when I was quite young, we went on a walk around the village that we were staying in the Upper Blue Mountains. And we saw a deserted house. And whenever you see a deserted house, you immediately pop in to the garden and you peer in the windows and you have fantasies about what you do with that house. And so I fell in love with that house, my mother fell in love with that house, and it's always stuck in my head. I've also become, well, I think that led me into architecture actually, which was my first degree, but the thing about the green bands is that they're actually very important for architecture and town planning. And I think anyone who knows Sydney will know that it would not look like it does now without the Builders Labourers Federation, the New South Wales Builders Federation, and the green bands that they put on very important areas, historical buildings and so on. And so that's the only reason why we've got such a lovely downtown Sydney. But I don't want to get deflected into a lecture on Sydney. So I'll just say that fascination with the green bands and led me into thinking about a character who might have had something to do with the very first green band, which those of you who know Sydney probably know Hunter's Hill. And the very first green van was, I think it was June 1971. And so my character, my main character, she didn't live in Hunter's Hill because that's a very posh suburb. And she was not affluent at the time. But she was asked by a friend to be engaged in it. So I wanted to have green bands, old houses, blue mountains, and a story. So that the story, maybe I'll leave you to ask your next question.
Yes, I mean, the architecture background was important in your last novel too, and I haven't made that connection here. So you think that's another reason for sort of looking in this direction at sort of protection of the environment?
Oh, definitely. Definitely, because we've got the cultural heritage, we've got the old buildings, we've got communities, you know, townscape, as well as the landscape. Not to mention the simple fact of surviving on this planet. So I think they all come together and they're all important.
So you obviously know the Blue Mountains well, but could you take us, you know, through some of the research that you did for the novel? I mean, particularly, I suppose, on the green bands and what kinds of I guess, background reading and so on that you needed to do for that?
excuse me, I read the books by the Bergman, Mother and Daughter. That's a very good book. It's a bit turgid, actually, but they've done a very... I hope there's no relative here. There's a very, very nice summary, which they both wrote, in the Dictionary of Sydney, which is an online resource so that you can read all about the green bands there. And there's another book written by a Sydney town planner, Tom... I've actually forgotten his name, but it was published by New South Wales Press in 4 or 5 years ago. And that's a very readable book. And it goes through every green band and relates it to the environment, to the, you know, the buildings, the issues and so on. So that was a wonderful resource. And then with regard to the mountains, well, I think from the time I was an early child, they were part of us, because we went up there just about every year. And my parents took us, my sister and myself, down every valley, up and down. And you know how the Blue Mountains, they're not actually mountains, it's actually a plateau that's been eroded away over the millennia. And so I just feel it's part of me. So, and in fact, my parents retired there. So we really love them.
There's a really strong sense of place in the book. Could you tell us a little more about the main character? So it's centred on a woman named Claire Barclay. Who's Claire Barclay, and how does she fit into this picture?
Well, Claire Barclay has taken my grandmother's name, surname. But Claire Barclay was a teacher. She married happily, she thought, and then her husband died in a shooting accident. They had a small property in a place called Wombat Valley, which is not to be confused with Kangaroo Valley. And then her husband had a shooting accident and he died. And she discovered that after his death, that he'd taken out an immense second mortgage. He had no idea, she had no idea about that, what it was for, what he'd spent the money on. Was it fast horses, fast women? She had absolutely no idea.
I think your phrase in the book was, which I love, I did chuckle over, speaking of things like tweeds, slow horses and fast women and slow horses.
Yes.
Fast women and slow horses, which I love. It's a wonderful phrase.
Yes, yeah, so after she was very poor after he died. She had to give up the house, the property, her daughter, and she had to move. It was a devastating time, really devastating. So imagine that you're left without a house, without your home, without your husband, all sorts of questions about why on earth did he do that and not tell you. So when she was fortunate enough to inherit a house in Numbulla, not to be confused with Blackheath in the mountains, she embraces this as a wonderful opportunity to start a new life, throw in her job as a teacher, and we all know how hard teaching is, and move to the mountains. And then things start to happen with regard to unraveling her past with her husband and other aspects, and with the now and the future, what is going to happen to this mountains community when these greedy people start, you know, thinking of plans the way they always do, of how to spoil the wilderness. So that's the story.
Yes, the villains, we'll get to them in a moment. I mean, like so many of your novels, Alison, I mean, this one is, it's a really sensitive treatment, I think, of women in society, really, and there are a number of, I guess, women's friendships that are that feature in the novel. And I was very taken with, kind of, especially call it an episode or a sequence of events where Claire is writing a speech for Mark, isn't he? She's writing a speech for Mark to deliver at a big rally in Sydney. They're all going to go to Sydney for a rally.
Yeah, Mark is president of the Conservation Society.
And I think your choice to make her the speechwriter and for him to deliver it was very interesting. I want to ask you about that. And then, we won't give away the plot, but basically it so happens that Claire has to actually deliver that speech in the end, or at least finish delivering it. And it struck me you were telling us something much broader there, I think, about women and women's agency and women's voices. So I really just want to ask you about the way that, I think feminism, and I mean the contemporary women's movement, of course, is women's liberation is taking off at the very moment that you're dealing with here in relation to the green bans. I mean, we, yeah, so if I could perhaps just ask you to draw out a little bit on the way in which you saw women's role within this story.
Yes. so this was the beginning of the second wave of feminism, early 1970s, and this I often think what you're saying, that this, you mentioned this was done in a gentle way, and I've always been a very strong feminist. My mother was a very strong feminist. She sent me to, I say she advisedly because my father wasn't keen on this idea, of going to an all-girls school. And one of the things I've often thought about is that this idea that women might listen very nicely, then go out and do precisely what they want. And that's what these women characters in this book are doing. So that while they're not fighting, you know, really strongly, they are building up themselves to a realization of where they can go. And because it was just the beginning of the second wave of feminism, I didn't take it to, I mean, it was a big achievement for Claire to get her voice in this novel, both literally and metaphorically.
Yeah, I guess another aspect of that theme is, you know, the menace of violence hangs over the whole novel, really. That's been a theme of previous novels. If I think of The Philosopher's Daughters in particular, where I think it's relevant. And I just wonder, if I could draw you out on that. I mean, it's been a, you know, it's a theme, I guess, of the short stories and fictional writing of the classical period of Australian literature, you know, the late 19th, early 20th century. I think The Drover's Wife, Lone Woman, Bush, and also, you know, Henry Lawson's short story, or Barbara Bainton's Bush Studies, where, again, you know, that physical violence against women or the threat of it are just so central. And I wonder what role that plays here, do you think? I mean, were you also, I guess, saying something about the fundamental violence of the developmental ethic that's going on here? I mean, they're effectively proposing our real estate agents, our you know, local aldermen and all the rest of it, are proposing a kind of violence against this place as well.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, really, really violent attitudes and behaviour. And I think that is something that, I mean, you mentioned that it was found in earlier literature, but I think that's something that pervades everything with women's lives, that and I won't go into what I've written about in economics, which is that men have upper body comparative advantage and women don't. And so that makes men fundamentally potentially violent and has, you know, from the beginning of time, I imagine. So that I think that there's something about men and women in our culture still, that where there can be violence and where women have always to be careful. You know, we try and change the culture and we've gone some way to changing the culture, but still life is dangerous potentially. So that has pervaded all my novels as well.
And it's interesting how one of mine, sort of as you talk through a book, new ideas appear, and one has just appeared to me. Jo is, apart from Claire, Jo is the most developed male portrait, I think, in this novel. But Jo's a little boy. Jo's still to become a man. Were you sketching out the possibility that there's a different kind of masculinity in store for us with Jo? Because Jo sketches birds, and Jo is sensitive, and Jo is capable of a very, what would you say, a harmonious, productive loving, in some ways, relationship with Claire?
Yes. Now, that's a very deep question, Frank.
Well, as I said, I only thought of it then.
No, I do love...
I've sprung it on you. I was going to ask you about Joe.
Yeah. No, I love conversations with Frank because it's full of these sudden insights. And it's just wonderful. And I just want to backstep a bit and say that in what I said about men and women's relationships, I didn't mean to say that men are not sensitive and, you know, that they are. The trouble is you don't always know which ones are the sensitive, gentle ones and which ones are the ones who are going to bash you up. So, going back to Joe, yes, he's a lovely boy. I'm very fond of him. He just appeared in the book and, you know, stayed there. But he's quite important, and he and Claire met very early on. In fact, it was like they were contesting ownership of Bellevue, the old house, and to begin with, there was a lot of defensive attitudes from both, but then they were united by the glossy black cockatoos. And I don't know if any of you know the glossy black cockatoos, which are getting more and more rare, unfortunately, yes. And so that antagonism gradually grew into friendship and more than that into love, because this boy, 10 years old, vulnerable, and his mother was lost to cancer. And so you can see in a situation like that how easy it would be for the family to disintegrate. And so his part of the plot is about how he's worked his way through that and how Claire and he have helped, because her daughter is overseas and, you know, it's that relationship has filled a gap in each of their lives. And that I really do love the idea of cross-generational friendships as well, which I think is so important.
Yeah, and there's that moment in the novel where we see Claire in an initial stage, a stage of misunderstanding, I think, through the eyes of him and his friend Danny. And she seems a bit kind of unhinged and they're hostile, of course, initially, aren't they?
Very hostile.
And it's quite interesting the way that you develop the friendship between them from that moment, I think. But I wanted to ask you also about ethnicity. I mean, you know, you're very sensitive in your novels to the ways in which societies are changing, and I was struck in this one too that, you know, it's an Anglo-dominated society, I suppose, but, you know, we also encounter migrants and children of migrants. So we've got Stavros, who's Australian-born but of sort of Greek background, so he kind of, like me, I suppose, he kind of passes as almost Anglo-Australian, he's a cricketing type Aussie.
Are you a cricketing type?
Well, I was once upon a time.
Right,
I was. Yeah, I used to open the batting for Fairfield A&A Cricket Club, which is kind of A&A, you know, being that grotesquely racist organisation going back to the 19th century. Anyway, I used to open their batting in Melbourne. So there's Stavros, and there's Iggy, who's Slovenian, but an artist as well as a worker. You've got Danny, who's Joe's friend from school who comes from a Chinese Australian background. And I was reminded of your last novel, The Painting, that also explores, I think, really Europeans and Europeanness in an Australian and often an Anglo-Australian context. So could you talk a little bit about that, I guess? And is that an important part of your writing in terms of producing a sense of the dynamics of a particular society to have, you know, to explore those senses of difference, I guess?
Yes, it's very important, and I think this is a legacy of the post-Arthur Caldwell era and the Second World War again. I think, like most people, I found the Second World War and what happened to the world, to refugees everywhere, endlessly interesting. And what Arthur Cornwell did, for those of you who might not know, was he changed immigration policy before the end of the Second World War. It was actually, I think, a couple of months before the end of the Second World War. And, I mean, they didn't do anything radical, like allow people from Asia to come in, but what they did say that, you know, with post-war reconstruction, what we're going to need is a workforce, and Britain wasn't going to lose its workers to Australia because it needed it itself to reconstruct all the damage there, so that the really quite radical idea of scooping up displaced persons from these camps all over Europe and bringing them to Australia was just such an important thing. And the notion of increasing the population, this was one easy way of doing it. So that when I went to school in Sydney, I came across the children of many of these displaced persons who'd come to Sydney, and there were all sorts, you know, the Hungarian, Yugoslav, former Yugoslav, Greek. And so that's always been very important in my perception of Australian society post-war. And it's one of the wonderful things that you scratch, that I think about our country, if you scratch someone who looks very Australian, like you, and you discover that they are, you know, that they have this diverse, rich background. So I find that endlessly fascinating. So the character Iggy from Slovenia, his story is actually the story of one of our my family's old friends. That's what he did. And, you know, he came from a labor camp after the Second World War and got off the train at the Blue Mountains eventually after being working in Bachelor in the Northern Territory and working in Tasmania, reconstruction. And, you know, the village is important to him. But with regard to the Chinese, that maybe I'm going on a bit long about this, but the Chinese boy, his family came out to Australia way back in the middle of the 19th century, working on at Hill End out in near Bathurst, gold digging. And so he's more Australian than most of the people, and he and Joe, this is the friend, have a very tight friendship because of the fact that they're bullied at school. And one of the ironies is that the boy that's bullying them at school is from London. You know, he's the perfect Anglo boy, and doesn't like Danny, the Chinese boy.
So is it too early to ask what's next? Are we allowed to do that, or is that a taboo subject for novelists?
It's a taboo subject, but I could give you a few hints.
Yeah. Some hints would be great. Yeah.
So it involves a landscape, which, of course, you have to have one of those. No, it's actually, there's a bit of architecture in there too, but it's mainly the physical landscape. Mm-hmm. And it involves, I don't know how many points of view, and it's going to be historical again. I think I'm a frustrated historian. And it's going to be further back in history, but not as far back as the Philosopher's Daughters.
Well, it sounds absolutely wonderful. I think I made the quip last time. I'd learnt before we spoke last time that There is some sort of strict requirement, if you're calling something a historical novel from some group or something, that has to be before a certain date. But I regard the 70s, like the 80s, as history, Alison. So I'm prepared to accept you as a historical novel. It's history.
Oh, thank you.
I thought you'd really appreciate it.
I did say to you last time that I thought the sex lives of the 1980s was maybe not quite history.
No, not quite history yet. It's a bit recent, yeah. So we've got time for questions, and Alison's graciously agreed to answer some questions. So do you run
No,
I wasn't sure. So, yeah, if anyone would like to ask any questions, I think we can do it from here. Yes.
It's a bit of both, because I do try and write it out beforehand, because I really like to know where I'm going, but then I start writing and then other stuff pops up and I realise that I've made mistakes of logic and so on, so it's continuously evolving. And so that although I think I know where I'm going, I never do, and I go somewhere different. And that's one of the exciting things for me about the writing process.
Other questions? Anne Brown.
Hello. First, a comment that I was saying, I really love the character of Joey. And I really relate to him because he loves birds, he loves drawings, and he also has that private space, which I think is so important for children. You know, like you can sort of camp somewhere. It's such a contrast to Claire's space, which is, you know, inherited, it's a sort of financial transaction. Whereas kids can enjoy a space just because they decide to hang out there or something. But seeing I have to have a question mark, my question mark is that I found one puzzling thing about the novel, and that was that Claire didn't seem very scared of the threatened violence and the fact that she had almost been killed, you know, a couple of times. And I'm just sort of wondering why you did that, because it just, these awful things were happening to her, and yet she didn't seem to care that much.
Yes, I thought she was scared too.
Okay.
Yeah.
Maybe I just thought she should be more scared.
Well, actually, someone wrote to me and said that they thought that she was a weak woman. Well, they didn't quite say it like that, but was the implication. Well, she was a weak woman because she was scared. She shouldn't have been. She should have been strong.
Like a Xena warrior princess.
Yes.
I'm looking for Xena. Yeah.
Yes.
A made up character.
Yes. And if you read the book, you'll see that. Well, as Anne said, that there are some not very nice things. But you can, if you do read the book, just see whether you think she should have been more scared or less scared, or exactly the right amount of scaredness. And I prefer you to have the last.
Yes, Karen.
So, Alison, you know, there's an overarching sense of tension throughout the book. And, of course, there's a sense of mystery about what is actually going on. Surely some of that must be planned in advance, because, you know, those twists and turns are not always easy to thread in unless you have some thoughts. Do you do much planning in that way? Like, I know novels take their own direction, but...
Yeah, they do, yes. Yes, I do a bit of planning in that direction, absolutely. I mean, I make mistakes sometimes, and then something better replaces it. I mean, you know what it's like, don't you? These endless writes and rewrites that you do as new things come up and so on. But with regard to the, this particular novel was a bit easier. It was the last one that I found very difficult because there had to be someone who'd actually committed an individual crime. And I didn't know who that was myself. So I wrote and wrote and wrote, and then I realized I had to introduce a new character. So that involved, you know, going right back and threading it through. But that's part of the writing that I really love. The rewriting is my favorite bit. It's getting the first draft down that is very, very difficult. When you work and work and work and you've only done another 300 words.
Any more questions?
Yes, Nick. So I grew up in Richmond, very close to the band, in the 80s. So I was curious.
Where did you grow up?
In Richmond.
Richmond, yes.
So not quite a good nuns, but at the.
Yes.
So I was curious as to how much Blue Mountains, the character in the novel, was different about Blue Mountains compared to the rest of Sydney. How do you kind of contrast that to what most people would consider Sydney compared to the outskirts?
Ooh. Well, actually, I'm not sure that I fully understood.
Yeah, I guess my question is, what's different about the Blue Mountains? Like, what's unique about the setting in the Blue Mountains, which is maybe different to the rest of Sydney? You can't talk about Sydney.
Yes.
So what's unique about the mountains in the novel?
Well, the wilderness. It's the wilderness. It's so much of it being uncharted. I mean, the additions to the Blue Mountains recently, to the western part of the Blue Mountains, they've added that stone gardens or whatever it's called. That's been included in the area at the National Park. And thinking of the Wollamai Pine, the fact that that could be discovered, which is a really ancient form of tree, that could be discovered so recently and so close to Sydney. So I think that's what I love about the Blue Mountains, that it's so close to Sydney and yet it's so really wild, and you can go into gorges and things, and if you're lucky now, I mean, certainly when I was growing up, you would not see another person. And that's wildness is its attraction, I think. Just as here we've got the attraction of Namaji, for example, the wildness. But so Richmond, yes, that's a lovely part of the world to grow up in, actually. All those rivers. Maybe it's a bit far from Sydney University.
Yes, Bob, I think back to Alex. Oh, close, did you finish up?
There we go. Thank you very much. Look, it only leaves me to say that the books are at the back here. And look, please take my tip. You don't need alcohol as you go into winter. You just need really good reading. So buy many, many copies. Then go to a bookshop and buy Dreamers and Schemers as well. But look, it's been a really wonderful conversation. I think Mutt is a great character as well in the book. And I think, you know, really warded off the baddies. And I think the baddies are great, actually. So we won't go right in. I still think Jack was murdered. But Alison, please thank both Professor Frank Bongiorno and Alison Booth. And if you are interested, thank you so much for coming and supporting camera writing. Thank you so much.